In our community, it seems to be a very apt time for a pride sermon. I think it was Tuesday, I had a confluence of three events. I read or heard Mayor Jacobs' response to the vile sheriff who called for state-sanctioned violence against homosexuals and transgender persons. It didn't go as far as I might have liked, but knowing where he started, it was quite a journey. And I much appreciated it. That same day, I watched Wanda Sykes' new stand-up special on Netflix, which I highly recommend. It is spicy, but I'm comfortable with that, and if you are, it's well worth watching. It's a very trenchant critique of the American political scene at this moment. Mostly it deals with race, and only by context, gender and sexuality. But was quite forthright about the prejudices and stereotypes we employ. And then that very evening, I read an article in The Economist about new fragments in the Southern Baptist Evangelical Coalition, how some 40% of people in the convention, I think it's the SBA, did not want Mike Pence to speak at their convention of a year ago, and how the alignment between the churches and far-right governments seems to be betraying some of the ideals that moderates in the convention had. I spoke to colleagues about this. And also, of course, revelations of sexual impropriety. So they're really in crisis, which I wish for them and for my colleagues in the movement strengthens them ultimately and helps them find a great vision for the future. But all of this has concentrated my mind that evening and beyond on the prejudices that still linger in the American body politic. And today, as part of Pride celebrations, both now and in anniversary of the Stonewall protests, we're going to talk mostly about sex, gender, and sexuality, which are issues that have floated around my personal life and career for years. But they also form a prism through which we understand all of our intolerances. So I'll address that as well. And let's be honest. You know, I spoke just a few minutes ago about physicality, and I mentioned obliquely sexuality, and it makes us all squeamish or squirm. It made our sages uncomfortable. They were, despite what I said about Boyar and their comfort with our being incarnate creatures, they were mostly pretty young men and still giggly about sexuality. When the people lust after meat, a bar mitzvah student said that they get poisoned meat, which I love that idea, no one's ever said, but they get meat and they are destroyed by it. And he said, oh, the meat must have been poisoned. And it's entirely consonant with the reading. So the place where all those people are buried is called Kivrot HaTa'ava, the graves of lust. And our sages in Midrash suggest that what they were lusting for was not merely meat, but sexual indiscretion that perhaps they had when they lived among Egyptian or other pantheistic communities. I only bring that up because as humans, sexuality is never far from our experience. So here's why I think I was quite nervous. Being with a few amino acids and genetic codes apart away from, I am essentially heterosexual and trans, cisgender. Right? I can't speak to you about the experience of a homosexual, gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender person from personal experience, and therefore I probably shouldn't be the person speaking to you. Be that as it may, I am, at least in nominally, your spiritual leader, and need to address all things we deal with as human beings and give you Jewish wisdom on such. But I'm going to enter into this conversation or try to with a certain level of humility. Moses in this parasha is talked about in one of many places as the most humble. I think it was in your reading. It's not always borne out by his actions, but nevertheless, humility is a great cornerstone for any sort of spiritual practice. So I want to preface at the very least that I have no great expertise in the subject I'm going to speak on. But I do want to start with a few things that bother me, sort of in the dialogue about LGBT issues. First is the words homophobic and transphobic, which implies that people who oppose full equality for gays, lesbians, bisexual persons, transgender persons are just afraid. No, they're hateful. I am not comfortable with that word. It excuses intolerance. They may need to learn. They may not have had experiences. They may not be hateful. They may have valid intellectual and or religious reasons to excuse themselves, to separate. But it's not fear. I think that's a lie. And I also think, and again, this is the place where I most strongly feel I am unequipped to have this conversation. I think LGBTQ acronyms do a great disservice to the persons contained under that umbrella. A feminine-presenting lesbian in San Francisco is not having the same experience as a transgender woman in Knoxville as is a gay man living in Chelsea, New York. They're very different experiences, as is a bisexual woman working at Oak Ridge National Labs. Those are all unique experiences. And I think this is what Wanda Sykes was pointing out too. And when we talk about race, and a colleague points out that stand-up comedians are like today's prophets, speaking out against a system. And Ken, you've done sort of your graduate work on the jester in literature and that role. But at the very least, when we talk about broad concepts, and when I came to talk at Carson Newman, I hinted at this, we do a great disservice to talk about the African-American community or the Latino immigrant community or the Jewish community. I mean, are we the same as our Orthodox brethren in everything we believe? Or is every person in this room part of a monolithic cohort? No. People have very different experiences. And so I want to put that in the background because it's always peeved me. Both that we excuse lack of tolerance as fear and that we lump together the experiences of very diverse groups of people and very diverse individuals. You know, white homosexuals have a much different experience than black homosexuals, for one thing. So that said, I want to talk about what Judaism says about loving a person of the same gender and what Judaism says about persons who know themselves to be of a different gender than they are biologically, where they are announced biologically, so to speak. Curiously enough, so in the past 20 years in America, our views and understanding of homosexuality has radically shifted. No less than 20 years ago, in many states it was illegal and punishable, and you could be incarcerated for having homosexual relations, and now every state permits homosexual marriage. So we should perhaps applaud ourselves for how far we've come so quickly. It's an interesting development. I doubt in many lives you'll see such a radical change in human understanding and American society than you do about that in less than two decades. But interestingly, to Judaism, our sages and tradition was much more comprehensive about people being transgender than about people being homosexual. As early in the Mishnah, people make a lot of bones about this more than I think they should, but there's some limited understanding about a spectrum of biological sex and understood gender. It's not complete, but as early as 1900 years ago, they understood that physicality doesn't always correspond to gender identity. Now, that said, I don't want to make too much of that. They had a bare understanding of that. But as much as I think 3 to 4 centuries ago, there were people who were born biologically female who understood themselves, knew themselves to be male, and were counted in a minion. And I mean, of course, a minion where only males were counted. There's also, in the 19th century, I think his name is Eliezer Waldenberg, he's known as the Tzitz Eliezer. He and others write about the question, if a marriage is contracted between a man and a woman, well, they didn't know any other marriage, and one of the partners later transitions to a different gender, is a get required? And at no point do they question the validity of transitioning gender. The only question is, do you need a get? Which is a very arcane piece of, you know, it was the marriage, so to speak, contracted under false premises. You thought you were marrying a man, but it was actually a woman, right? But they never question the one's self-conception being paramount, and that gender is only understood, or is primarily understood internally and socially constructed externally, but is not a defined quantity at birth. So I've always found that interesting, that our community was more comfortable with issues of the T than the GLB. And frankly, with regard to homosexuality, to people loving people of the same gender, we're not on great ground. I'm not going to lie to you. I think we should be honest about our tradition. I have pointed out to you before, and I strongly believe this, that in Leviticus, when it says that loving another man or having intercourse with another man is a toevah, I don't know if King James started this, but it wasn't King James who wrote the King James Bible. It was Jesus, of course. I forget who translated the Bible for King James. It was a committee? That's the way a hippopotamus was created, by committee. It's not an abomination. It is not an eternal category with its sort of ontological verity. It doesn't have a real truth to it. It's clearly a taboo, a socially mediated taboo, because they use the same word to talk about magic, and they use the same word to talk about Egyptians and Hebrews eating together. The word is taboo, or maybe anathema. Ooh, that makes me uncomfortable, is what they're saying. Oh, as something as simple as, and I've been in cultures where, you know, you drink your beer out of millet, we make our beer out of wheat, your beer is gross. But enjoy it, right? That's what a toevah is, effectively. That says Leviticus and the rabbinic enterprise build on that, and once sort of scaffolding is built around a primary law Jewishly, even if the primary law can be re-understood, it doesn't necessarily eliminate the scaffolding. We don't exist solely through Torah. We exist through the matrix of rabbinic and post-rabbinic understandings of Torah and commentary. So recently, rabbis whom I know and respect have made arguments that, A, whatever the Torah believed homosexuality to be, they are not talking about the same thing we know. For example, B, that homosexual relations in the ancient world were almost always power, hierarchy, and coercive relations. Or C, the Torah is not prohibiting homosexual love, it's prohibiting certain homosexual acts. Even if you believe those, they're not great, right? Because I do think there was understood to be homosexual love in the ancient world. David and Jonathan appear to be loving. Maybe they weren't sexually intimate, but they clearly loved each other. Jonathan loved David more than David loved Jonathan, I've said, right? And the other alternative, that all they were prohibiting was, to be blunt, anal sex, and then the conservative law committee said, so as long as you don't do certain sex acts, you can be gay. Well, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous, right? That's not how loving sexual lives work. And it's not fair because Maimonides clearly says of heterosexual relations, go ahead and do whatever you want. So we're going to tell other people no. And then my rabbi's response is, well, whatever they meant, that they're wrong. They can't have said what we think they're saying. Maybe. I find that to be a very incomplete answer. And because we exist in a non-literalist milieu, does anyone know why fundamentalists are called fundamentalists? I just learned this yesterday. This is fascinating. So around the turn of the century, someone published a series of pamphlets called The Fundamentals to try to reorient Protestant Christianity towards literalism. That's all it came from. So we exist as non-fundamentalists, as non-biblical literalists, and I think it's possible to say scripture and rabbinic interpretation was socially mediated, and societies change. And what was once anathema to a society doesn't need to be anathema to us. And frankly, I think another argument one could make, and Maimonides, I think, would have made this argument were he alive today, is that halakha needs to be responsive to sociology and science, other sciences. And so a wonderful colleague was talking, Christian colleague was talking about, who is, you know, a Baptist. He said, "What, you know, when my son gets married to another man, what am I going to do? I'll probably go and, I don't know, I can't officiate, but I'll probably sit there. Oh, maybe I'll sit in the back. I have to respect his choices." And I had to bite my tongue and say it wasn't a choice. But maybe what he meant is his choice of partner, the specific person, not the which gender. I don't know. But I think Maimonides would have read the scientific literature. I mean, that was who he was. He was a devout scientist in a lot of ways, and said, we know now that homosexuality is inherent in a person's experience and perhaps genetics, and it may have evolutionary reasons. They're starting to explore that now, and is not a choice. And he understood, I'm not going to quote that to you, but he understood elsewhere, if you don't have a choice in a matter, free will and sin mean nothing. So I'm going to read you what he does talk about on this week's parasha, which is the whole transition from a sacrificial system to a rabbinic system of prayer and worship. And you may have heard this, but it's based around some verses in this parasha, that it was in accordance with the wisdom and plan of God, says Maimonides in The Guide for the Perplexed, as displayed in the whole creation, that God did not command us to give up and discontinue all these older methods of service, which is to say, sacrifice and obeisance and incense burning. For to obey such a commandment would have been contrary to the nature of man who cleaves to what he or she is used to. Meaning, radical change is hard for people, right? And it might cause them to apostatize from their religion if you asked radical change of people. And he presents that it would also be the same if someone were to tell you today, stop praying. Right? You can't change that far. But inherent in that is an understanding that religion, like society, like history, is evolving, moves. And sometimes, as we've seen, moves backwards and moves forwards and two steps forward and one step back or two steps back and one step forward. And I think Maimonides, among others like him in sort of a hyper-rationalist school of understanding Judaism, would have accepted that halakha and practice have to accommodate or integrate science and modernity. And that's always been a tension, not just for fundamentalists, but for all Jews, is how much of science and modernity do we integrate? For example, in New York, they know that there are small crustaceans, microscopic crustaceans in the water. And so there are Jews who are extremist and only buy bottled water. But that tension of how much of a microscope are you going to allow? So I think undoubtedly we ought live in a world that, as Mayor Jacobs insisted, violence and certainly state-sanctioned violence is never an option, that we exclude that right away. And here's where it gets hard, and this is why I want to talk not just about sex, gender, and sexuality, but also about all of human difference, in parentheses. Because I'm really coming to this now. Tolerance isn't very exciting. I'm going to go this way. Inclusion's a little better, but the real goal is empathy, right? As I started my sermon, I can't speak from the perspective of a gay person, a black person, a transgender person, someone who is not American-born. But if you make, this is the Wanda Sykes issue, make some friends. You know, that to me, I'll be frank, I really did not understand transgender issues until I came here and had friends and acquaintances who knew that they were of a gender other than the one on the birth certificate. I used to think it was silly, and now I understand it's a life and death matter. So do it. Go out and have those conversations, those difficult conversations. And then as a community, here's what we have to work on. And I was nervous, I actually have to admit that, because you know, the understood sociology of Jewish communities in the South is that they're more liberal than their neighbors and more conservative than other Jewish communities, which I think is great. I think that's a nice, I'm a fan of political moderation and centrism. But I was, I have to admit, nervous, knowing that my perspective by the time I came here in 2010 was already pretty confirmed that homosexuality and to an extent being transgender was great. And I didn't know how it would work out here. And I've been a part of some conversations around homosexuality and transition that were, and let me explain this, a nothing burger, where I thought there were gonna be big and difficult conversations, and it was like there's a person, I don't wanna say anything about it, where we talked about coming out for months. And when the person came out, the in the environment it was, which is a synagogue environment, it was like, okay, so what's next on our agenda? No one cared. And it was kind of disappointing and kind of a great moment. You know, I couldn't believe it. I was like, we spent so much time getting ready to come out. Not me, but I was counseling the person. No one cared. It was so cool. I was so proud of us. And I mean, it's also possible no one was listening because it was one of those meetings where people were like, when is, you know, looking at their watches. But I've had that experience more than once. And I'm really relieved as a professional and happy for us that that's where we are. But we can still go further. So to finish up on Maimonides' comment about law, religion, and society growing, changing, evolving, sometimes forward, sometimes back, we get the commandment to create silver trumpets that will be used in the marches and eventually integrated into temple service. And in the Talmud, and in one rabbinic writing of the 20th century by Yecheskel Avramsky, it talks about how all of the things built in the wilderness had continuous use, but the trumpets had to be reforged in each generation. And everything Moses forged with Bezalel and others in the wilderness was kept. The trumpets he had to get rid of and start again every generation. And that imagery of each generation needing its own trumpets, I mean, that's great imagery when you're talking about synagogue development, but it's just a fact, right? The world your parents bequeathed to you with their prejudices, I mean, I'll be totally frank. My Zadie was one of the most beloved people in my life, and a few years after he died, my first girlfriend was a biracial woman, and I brought her home to Passover, and I really had the thought in the back of my head, oh God, if Zadie were here, what if he had said shvartza? Like I could totally picture that my Zadie had prejudices that I don't have, as beloved as he was to me. And we can try to be compassionate about that. In the same way that, you know, one generation butter is okay, the other generation butter will kill you. One generation you're supposed to put babies to sleep on their stomach, then you're told, don't fault your parents for what they believed and knew in their context. That's not exactly fair. But then as a community, we do have a responsibility and an opportunity to move forward. So Maimonides, again, in the same place in the Mishneh Torah, he talks about, with regard to this parsha, that everyone is obligated to help build the temple, both physically and financial, men and women, just like they did the sanctuary in the desert. Everyone has to build a sacred space for God. And we, who happen to be at one of the fortunate times for Jews in the world and in history, have even greater responsibility to build sacred spaces that integrate, care for, and show compassion for those different to us. Color of skin, belief, economic situation, gender orientation, sexual identity, all of it. And then I want to leave you with one thing. And this goes to, I don't think it was King, I think it was one of King's colleagues who said the idea, we ain't where we want to be, and we ain't where we ought to be, but thank God we ain't where we used to be. I'm poorly quoting that. That's us. You know, as Goethe said, do not hurry and do not rest. And so we live prayerfully into a world that will be better than the one we began. And as the past 20 years and as the past 50 years since Stonewall have shown, things get better, sometimes they get worse, sometimes they get ridiculous along the way. And there are going to be bathroom bills and things that are just political grandstanding. But prayers do get answered, and humanity can grow. And the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And I want to share with you the one thing I remember from my bar mitzvah was about Miriam getting shut out of the camp because of her psoriasis. So she gets shut out, and everyone waits for her. They loved Miriam because she provided the water. You get the sense that people loved Miriam. And Moses prays for her. El na refana la. It's one of the shortest prayers we know. Dear God, please heal her. And there's two pieces to that story. One is supporting each other, even in times of distress. And the other is praying, not just praying with words, but praying with our feet, as Heschel would have said. Praying with action to make the world better. And a midrash from roughly the 13th or the 14th century points out there are prayers that are answered after 100 years, and there are prayers that are answered after 90 years, and there are prayers, like in this week's parasha, that are answered after 7 days. And our prayers for full equality, whatever gender and gender identity, whatever sex and sexual orientation, and on, the things that make us different. As Wanda Sykes says, we're different but equal. Our prayers, we don't know when they'll be answered. Will it be decades or will it be days? We can't say. But we keep praying and praying with our feet.